In Chicago, the tower formerly known as Sears is now known as Willis Tower. That officially begins today, and it's already acquired a nickname, the Big Willie. NPR's David Shaper reports on the renaming of the tallest building in North America.
Chicago Mayor Richard Daley joined Willis Group corporate officials in pulling a black covering off the giant Willis Tower sign in the lobby of this iconic 110-story skyscraper. Willis Group Holdings, a London-based insurance company, bought the naming rights as part of its lease in the giant office tower. Chicagoans haven't been too kind to other corporate renamings. They picketed outside the historic Marshall Field's department store on State Street when it became Macy's, and many White Sox fans still refuse to call the former Comiskey Park U.S. Cellular Field, preferring simply the Cell. So New Jersey-born and bred Joe Plumeri, Willis Group's president and CEO, says he knows it might be hard for Chicagoans to call the Sears Tower they grew up with the Willis Tower.
You know, you can call it anything you want. And I said on TV yesterday, he called the Big Willie for all I care. Matter of fact, I wish you would.
For his part, Mayor Daley doesn't mind changing the name of the Sears Tower for a British company.
Big Willie, Willis, yeah, Towers, yes. You know why? Because they stepped up to the plate.
Bringing new jobs downtown, says the mayor. But for Chicagoans outside of the Willis Tower, the new name is hard to swallow.
It's always going to be the Sears Tower, you know.
Mike Hudgen of Suburban Displays says he just won't call it Willis, while the name change kind of bothers Susan DiCostanza of Chicago.
Yes, it does, because Sears is really a Chicago institution, I feel like, and it's strange that it would be called anything else.
Reginald Snow of Chicago feels the same.
I don't like it. I grew up on the Sears Tower, so.
As for the nickname Big Willie, Snow says,
I'll keep my comment to myself for now.
Probably a good call. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago. Big Willie style's all in it, getting jiggy with it. Getting jiggy with it. Getting jiggy with it.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand in California.
Hi, I'm Charles Phoenix, a Los Angeles pop culture historian.
And the first person in our new series we're calling California Characters. While we co-host the show from California, we're profiling people who in some way embody the Golden State and can give us some insight, some inside knowledge about what California is all about. It's a place that looms large, not only in our economy, but in our collective imagination. Charles Phoenix loves to imagine what L.A. used to be, and he takes us there. He gives tours of places locals often overlook. I met up with him on Alvera Street in downtown Los Angeles, where the city began as a Mexican pueblo.
You can get your maracas, your cowboy hats.
My favorite Mexican wrestling outfits for the kids, for the whole family, really. I like that chicken guy. Look at him. Chicken guys aside, this place is full of the kitschy history that Charles Phoenix has spent his life documenting. So Charles, when you say that you're a historian, not in the classical sense, i.e. you got your PhD in American history at Harvard, you're really self-taught and it is your passion. Where did this come from?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, basically, it all started, I was raised on a used car lot. I mean, well, we actually had a house, but my dad was a used car dealer, so I got tuned into vintage cars at an early age, and then I was so fascinated by them always that I kind of attached myself to what else came from the period of these vintage cars that I liked so much. And then I decided I want to really kind of go out in the world and see what's left of all this old stuff. And I started with my own, you know, community, which is Los Angeles.
When people who aren't from here think of L.A., a lot of them have probably cliched images of Los Angeles, the never-ending sprawl or the Hollywood sign or the beach. If you could disabuse anyone of that image and tell them what L.A. really is, what would you say?
I think a lot of the charm of Los Angeles, a lot of what I call authentic L.A., gets kind of swept under the rug these days, and they don't know to come to Alvera Street and have a taco or a taquito on the patio, or they don't know to go to Clifton's Cafeteria and see, you know, old school LA. It is one of the last surviving cafeterias, large-scale cafeterias in the entire country, if not the last one. It's done in a themed environment, which it's been since 1935. It's incredible. There's a waterfall in this restaurant from the 1930s.
Now, when you say authentic Los Angeles, I'm interested in how you say what's authentic is a theme. So it's already kind of one step removed from reality in terms of it being a manufactured space, a manufactured environment. That's interesting to me. That's very Los Angeles.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, Disneyland perfected, you know, themed environmental spaces. And I'm a child of Disneyland. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And so the reality for me is wherever I travel in the world, I kind of accidentally sometimes go, wow, that reminds me of Disneyland. Or, you know, driving up and down any street, I'll go, oh, that's kind of Adventureland. Oh, if it's Western, that's kind of Frontierland. Or if it's futuristic or modern, I'm saying, oh, that's kind of Tomorrowland, you know. I was in Paris going down the Seine River on one of their riverboat tours, and everything was all lit so beautifully and everything. And I said to my French friend, I said, this boat ride down the Seine River kind of reminds me of Disneyland. I do not discriminate against the classic and the kitschy cultures. Like, themed environments would be kind of a kitschy culture, yet a museum or whatever would probably be, or a historic building would be classic. I like to study both, and I like to pair them. Because one kind of complements the other, one kind of relieves the other.
So you've got the Disney Concert Hall, which is considered high art, right up the hill from where we are now, Alvera Street, which is considered a kitschy-themed environment.
You got it. And one goes hand in hand with the other. To me, they blend like salt and pepper.
What is your favorite treasure that you've discovered lately of Los Angeles? Because you were saying that you keep discovering all these things about Los Angeles. You're constantly searching for Americana and undiscovered neighborhoods in Los Angeles. What's the most interesting find you've come across recently?
Well, recently, since you ask, I was driving down Whittier Boulevard, which is an old main thoroughfare from between downtown Los Angeles and the southeast suburbs of L.A., and I saw this building from the 20s that I'd only seen in a book before, and it's shaped like a tamale. You've heard of like the famous Brown Derby and the big donut and all of that. Well, here is a big giant tamale that used to be, it's from the 20s, it used to be this tamale stand. Now, well, it's a Spanish-speaking income tax office, but still, I want to encourage people to be tourists in their own towns. But, you know, you've got to take a chance and go somewhere that you may not have been before or thought, well, I'm not interested in that. Get interested in it.
Cultural historian Charles Phoenix sharing his interest in Los Angeles and its high and low culture. If you want to see him and Alvera Street, there's a video at our blog, The Two Way. It's at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. It's not a great time to be a smoker. There are new restrictions and taxes on tobacco. It's also not the best economic environment to be starting a new venture. But none of that is daunting to Ernesto Perez Carrillo. He's a third-generation cigar maker in Miami. And in the world of cigars, he is a rock star. NPR's Greg Allen spent some time with Perez Carrillo as he works with his son and daughter to create a new signature cigar.
This is Ernesto Perez Carrillo's laboratory, a warehouse in Miami's Little Havana section.
You know, this particular tobacco comes from Nicaragua.
Perez Carrillo has been involved in the cigar business for most of his 57 years. With his shaved head and hawk-like glare, he's almost an intimidating presence as he inspects some tobacco samples. These leaves of tobacco are what are called fillers and binders that will go into his new cigars.
This is all basically, you know, Q&C tobacco. And if you see the texture, feel that. Mm-hmm. Now feel this one. You see this?
That's drier. This is more oil.
Exactly. Then you also, what you do, you also smell the tobacco. Mm-hmm. You smell that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you smell this one. Has a completely different...
Yeah, this has got a... kind of a more distinctive
smell.
You know?
Exactly.
Not a lot of cigars are made anymore in Miami. Most companies have long since moved production offshore. There was a time, though, in the 1960s and early 70s when cigar factories here in Miami and in Tampa were at the heart of a thriving industry. But by the late 70s, when Perez Carrillo took over his father's business, cigar sales were in decline. Perez Carrillo wasn't making much money. Then in 1982, he tasted what he considers a truly great cigar, a Cuban-made Davidoff that a friend brought from London. He began a quest to recreate that experience with his own cigar.
Some people smoke for strength. Other people smoke because of the brand, or, you know, they like the band. I smoke because I want to feel not just the senses around my palate, but the whole body. And with this particular cigar, that's what I felt, you know. And then when I finally got the blend of La Gloria Cubana, I had that same feeling.
That cigar, La Gloria Cubana, changed Perez Carrillo's life. In 1992, it received a top rating from what at the time was a brand new magazine, Cigar Aficionado. In the office at his Little Havana warehouse, with his son and daughter listening in, Perez Carrillo recalls that he attended an event introducing the magazine at an industry trade show.
And then when I get back to the booth, I see a line of people in front of my booth. And I'm looking at those people, I say, you know, because it was a little booth. So I go there, and people start, hey, you know, I want to order. And I'm saying, you know, what is this?
How many orders did you come out then from that?
That first day was $25,000.
It was the beginning of an industry-wide boom in cigar sales. La Gloria Cubana became one of the most sought-after brands. Perez Carrillo opened a second, larger factory in the Dominican Republic and soon was producing over 7 million cigars a year. By then, his daughter Lisette was working part-time at the Miami store and planned to return to the business full-time after law school. But in 1999, the family got an offer too good to refuse. A big corporation, Swedish Match, agreed to buy the cigar company, reportedly for more than $20 million. Lisette says her family decided, reluctantly, to accept the offer.
It was a difficult decision for all of us.
You were a little bit disappointed. One part of you, though, was.
I was very disappointed. I mean, to me, La Gloria is still part of, you know, still part of us. I mean, all my friends, you know, that's the cigar I give out at my house. And that's the cigar that is just part of our lives for so long.
Lisette says she smokes 2 or 3 cigars a week, not many compared to her father's 10 a day. She's proud of her family's connection to cigar making, a tradition that began with her grandfather, who started out making penny cigars on Havana street corners. Among the people she's met, she says there's never been a stigma attached to cigars. In fact, quite the opposite. When I ask about health concerns associated with tobacco and the FDA's new authority over tobacco products, Ernesto Perez Carrillo says he's not worried. Cigars, he says, are a natural product.
You know, I've been in the cigar business since the early 70s. And quite frankly, I've never heard of anybody, you know, getting any type of disease or anything from cigars.
Dr. Michelle Block, a researcher with the National Cancer Institute, says the health risks are very real.
There is no question. There are definitive studies showing that cigar use is hazardous to health.
Block says cigar smokers especially have an increased risk of oral or esophageal cancer. However, she says health risks are strongly linked to how much you smoke, and that as many as 3/4 of cigar smokers smoke only occasionally. Despite increasing regulation and an economic recession, the Perez Carrillo family is excited about its new business venture. They plan to release their first product, a limited edition inaugural cigar, this fall. It will be a small business, they say, one of a growing number of boutique cigar makers specializing in premium cigars, but priced under $10. In charge of marketing research is Ernesto Perez Carrillo III, 27 years old, who's worked as a management consultant and on Wall Street. He acknowledges that in a recession and the current regulatory climate, starting a new cigar company might seem risky.
If we were trying to be a big, big company, I think we'd be very, very concerned right now.
But, he notes, last year 300 million cigars were sold in the U.S.
I think whether the market is, you know, 450 million, 300 million, 100 million, there's always going to be a role for someone like my father, who's just an expert, a master blender, someone who creates great cigars.
For marketing research, there are a few places better than Sabor Havana in Coral Gables. It's a cigar store and smoking lounge. There's usually smoke in the air and a domino game in progress. Cigar blogger and columnist Gary Arst quotes Charles Dickens, saying that with the rise of new boutique brands like Perros Carrillo's, it's the best of times and the worst of times for cigar smokers.
We have the finest array of cigars available to us, but we are beset on all sides by taxes and by, I don't say they're anti-smoking people, they're people that probably don't enjoy their lives and don't want you to enjoy yours. They don't want you to smoke out of doors.
A number of communities are moving toward bans on smoking in public places outdoors. The Perros Carrillo family is ready for that trend as well. They're working at their little Havana warehouse to create their own retail store and smoking lounge. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Let's get serious now. What was that one case that Perry Mason lost? We have a little conflicting information. From the web, we hear it was this one, the case of the deadly verdict.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled cause, fix the punishment as death for the crime of murder as charged in the indictment dated August 24th.
You wish to have the jury polled, Mr. Mason?
No, Your Honor. That won't be necessary.
Why wasn't it necessary? And what about the case of the witless witness, not to mention the case of the terrified typist? Didn't the verdicts go against Perry in those episodes, too? We're going to ask somebody who really knows, because she was there. Perry Mason's incredibly capable assistant all those years, Della Street, was played by the Emmy Award-winning actress Barbara Hale, who joins us now from her home in Sherman Oaks, California. Welcome to the program, Ms. Hale. How many cases did Perry Mason lose?
Robert, of course only one. You must realize that Perry never lost cases. And with the one that he lost, it was claimed a mistrial. As far as the show was concerned, he never lost a case.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you don't realize the other cases that were tried during the week when we weren't on television.
I see. So there were really umpteen thousands of cases that we just never saw.
That's right.
Uh-huh. But I've read on a website called the Perry Mason TV Show Book that in the case of the witless witness, that begins with a judgment being handed down against Perry. Doesn't count?
Oh, no.
No, I see.
See, those things were claimed mistrials.
I see. Whenever Perry Mason lost, it was eventually a mistrial.
Oh, absolutely.
In the case of the terrified typist, a jury returns, I'm reading this from the website, returns a guilty verdict against Perry's client, but Perry is still able to clear the defendant. I see. So he always...
Oh, absolutely.
He always would win in the end.
There was only one Perry Mason. You know, Robert, we did, about 330 shows. And believe me, my dear, it's very hard to think back and try to remember those things.
Yes. You and your colleagues provided a great many of us with a great many memorable moments, evidently including a very likely member of the Supreme Court.
That's very sweet, Robert. Thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure. And Barbara Hale, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, you're just lovely. It was grand talking to you.
Barbara Hale, who played the character Della Street in all those episodes of Perry Mason, in only one of which, she says, he lost the case.